Well, hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. Welcome back to the show. We have an extra special guest, a guest we've had on the show before, just not in audio form. We are thrilled to be welcoming back Ilan Eshkedi, who is a fantastic composer. You would know him from everything from Ninja Assassins to Shaun the Sheep to the recent Ghosts of Tsushima. And he really has a theme and an identity for every movie under the sun. Whether you like taciturn farmers who have playful barnyard animals to every kind of Shakespearean and Victorian era drama, all the way to alternative superheroes and stargazers, right up to those who are worthy enough to yield a katana. Welcome back to the show, Ilan. It is so good to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me on.
I don't know if you remember, we spoke in, I think, 2012, 2013, about Black Sea, the Kevin MacDonald submarine.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I do remember that, actually. Yes.
Excellent, excellent.
I really loved that movie. And it's really funny that Kevin and I we'd known each other for a while, and we'd been looking for an opportunity to work together. And for one thing or another, it had never quite come together. And finally, we got this chance to work on Black Sea, which I think is a really great bit of work from him, and I really loved doing it. It was a wonderful process, and somehow that movie just sunk without a trace, a bit like the submarine in the movie. Perhaps it was always doomed to failure. I don't know, but it was such a shame. And the only sort of the solace I could take from it is a friend of mine who I won't say who she is, but because she might not like it, but she's a quite famous film director. And she said, you know, I watched this film on the plane back from LA, and I didn't realize that at the end of it, I wasn't paying attention. I was like, this is a great film. And it had great music. And I saw that Kevin had directed and you'd done the music, and I'd never even heard about it. So that was the only compliment I ever had from it. So thank you for mentioning it.
Well, it really is. It is a shame that it didn't make more of a splash in the water, because, you know, Kevin MacDonald comes from a documentary background. So he tries to give the movie a lot of realism. And even though it's this heist film based on a kind of a true story, it's gripping. And every time I watch it and listen to your music, especially that one track, Leaving Sebastopol, it just takes you right in into the deep end. So, well, there's something else I wanted to tell you after we spoke. We had a discussion about Snowman and the Snow Dog, and I asked you, how do you follow Howard Blake? And I will never forget it. You said your MO, the entire thought process, was do your best, not shit, and hope that it all goes, all turns out well. So, I use that a lot. I just, every day I get to the office, do your best, not shit. Well, and actually I spoke to Mr. Blake last year.
Oh, really? Wonderful.
I don't know if I'm one of the only people on the planet who've spoken to both Snowmen composers, but I consider it a win. I love those, love those films and the scores.
Thank you. Well, especially it's remarkable coming, you know, from someone who's, you know, living in America, because it's not a big thing in America like it is over here, right?
Not really.
How did you come to know them?
Well, I saw it when I was younger. My dad had, my dad worked for Sony, and Sony was, I think, experimenting with putting different movies, different entertainment properties on a small, I don't know if it was Hi8 or it was whatever this video camera that you put on your shoulder.
Yeah.
It was like that small format. And I watched Beetlejuice, The Neverending Story, and The Snowman. And there's just something about watching that. It just captured my imagination. And to this day, I can't really take two steps without thinking of that music or the film. So I don't know.
Awesome. Brilliant.
I tell you what, I'm thrilled again to be speaking with you. Perfect Planet, fourth time working with David Attenborough. But before we get into any of that, can we go back to the very beginning and learn what string instrument really drew your attention? Why the piano was calling to you? What got you into the music biz?
Well, I mean, right at the beginning, I was, you know, my mom's a very talented pianist, not professional, but she was just very good at playing the piano. And so even when she was pregnant with me, she used to play these Chopin etudes that are sort of part of my DNA in a weird way, you know? And then my grandfather played the violin, my mother's father. He died just before I was born, but I still have his violin. And so my mom had me learn the violin. And so I learned the violin from the age of four. And so, you know, music was just always part of my life. And, you know, it wasn't really a choice. And then when I was 13, I wanted an electric guitar. You know, I was into Iron Maiden and Metallica. And so I got an electric guitar, a white Washburn. In fact, I found it quite recently. It's in my studio at the moment. I'm really enjoying playing it. It's amazing how these things travel through life with you, right? I mean, it's a cheap, you know, it was like a couple of $100 back in 1990, whatever, one, whenever it was bought for me. 1990, it would have been bought for me. So, you know, it's just like a sort of cheap old, you know, Washburn, but, you know, it means something to me. And so I learned the guitar that way. And then I just wanted to be in a rock and roll band, right? That was, you know, I mean, what kid doesn't, right? And I played guitar. I was like, I was into Guns N' Roses. I'll be Slash. You know, I wasn't bored back then. I had like long hair and I'd just like smoke a cigarette and I'd like have my hair in front of my face and I'd be like, you know, play Sweet Child of Mine. So, you know, and then when I was 19, I got introduced to Michael Kamen and Ed Shermer. And before I kind of knew what was happening, I was kind of in the film business more than I was in the music business. But that was fine. It was great. It was an incredible education. And as it happened, you know, so many things led me down that path. You know, I studied English literature at college. I have synesthesia. So all these things really made me, without particularly planning it, they gave me all the sort of perfect building blocks for being a composer who was going to work in the realm of narrative storytelling, whether that's film or video game or ballet or opera or, you know, whatever form you want it to take.
I think that trying to traverse the arts takes a lot of will, a lot of fortitude. And like you said, it was kind of in your blood, quite literally. What were some of the first songs you learned to play on the guitar?
I was four when I learned the violin. When I was 13 and I got a guitar, I mean, I learned the things that everybody learns. House of the Rising Sun, Blues Brothers, down, 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 down. You know, 12 bar blues. I suppose having played the violin, I had a bit of a head start. You know, I kind of understood certain things, certainly with the left hand, not so much the right hand. What else? There was a book. Everyone, I can't remember what the book was called. It had a brown cover. Everyone had that book and it had the notes written. It had tab as well that you could read. And there was other things like sort of old 60s hippie songs like where have all the flowers gone? And
that probably didn't make it stay
that in it. But then very quickly I was like, all right, how do you play Paradise City by Guns N' Roses, right? because and then, you know, and then quickly after that, Nirvana happened, right? There was a bit in between where I was really into hip-hop, into NWA and Public Enemy, but then Nirvana happened, right? I mean, I was so lucky. I had these amazing musical things happen at that, you know, right in the middle of my teen years. You know, there was NWA, Public Enemy, and then there was Nirvana and Pearl Jam, the Alice in Chains, and the whole Seattle grunge thing. And then immediately that was followed by the Britpop. Blur and Oasis. I mean, you know, what an incredible, I look back on, I mean, maybe every person looks back on their teenage life like this, but I feel like it was one, the 90s was one of the last eras of where music equaled culture. You know, the music you listened to determined the way you dressed, it determined the way you spoke, it determined the politics you believed in. It was music and culture were from the 60s to the end of the last century were intertwined, even with you know, what is now called electronic dance music. And that, in my day, there wasn't a generic term like that. You were either into house or trance or jungle or, you know, but depending on the music you listened to, that was like your cultural Bible. And so I went through a few different phases of that. And I feel lucky to have been able to experience that, because it also grew my love of synthesizers, of all different kinds of things that I use every day now.
No, that's fantastic. And I think that, you know, what, I play guitar, and one of the things that I learned a long time ago is that before you start to develop your own voice, you try to channel somebody else's voice. So whether it's like the Animals, like you said, or, you know, Oasis or Semisonic, or I was playing some Elton John, you know, it gives you, it's a way to channel and then also learn, and then you sort of develop your own path. A couple of things I'm glad you mentioned Metallica. I'm thrilled that you mentioned Guns N' Roses. And I wonder, you know, have you seen that movie with Bill Nighy, Pirate Radio?
Yes, I love that movie. I just had a brilliant memory as well of being a teenager and staying up too late and struggling to get out of bed to get to school. And I remember that for a while when I was really into Metallica, one of the ways that I would get myself out of bed is I would just reach over and pick up my Sony tape Walkman and put my headphones on with the dial up to 10 and play And Justice for All. and boy, would that wake me up and get me ready for the school day.
Sounds like that scene in Back to the Future where Marty wakes up George.
Yeah. exactly that.
So when was Guns N' Roses, Nirvana, was Metallica, were they sanctioned in the Ishkari home, or did you have to kind of sneak that amongst your friends?
Oh yeah, I mean, I didn't have to sneak it. My parents put up with it, but you know, no, my parents were big classical music lovers. You know, my dad liked his 60s pop as well. You know, there's definitely the beat, like sort of Beatles and you know, and sort of light, you know, light music, light pop music, you know, but it didn't have to be a secret, but no, that wasn't, you know, when I got in the car and was driven around by my mom, even now, if I get in the car with my mom, it's classical music all the way.
can't escape it. You know, I remember when I was in probably seventh grade, I got Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 on cassette. Mm. And I can't tell you how many nights in seventh and eighth grade I would fall asleep with Walkman just listening to those albums.
Yeah,
it just sort of, you know, developed.
That was one of the early concerts I went to. I was 13 years old. It was maybe the third gig I ever went to, was the Use Your Illusions tour with, wow. But you know what was amazing is that it was the support act was Soundgarden and Faith. It was Soundgarden, Faith No More, then the Guns N' Roses. And we got there. We arrived at like 9 o'clock in the morning and stood outside so we could be right at the front because it was in a stadium. And I never forget, I went with I took this girl. What was that? I can't remember her name. She had red hair. Oh man, I can't remember her name. And she had red hair. And we were with all my friends. But when the crowd stood, we were all sat down. It was a baking hot day. We were all in our sort of leather jackets with metal spikes on them and all that shit that you wore back then and DM boots. And this crowd stood up when the band, I can't remember, it must have been when I guess Soundgarden came up. And everyone, because everyone had more space because sitting down, the crowd just surged forward and everyone ran forward. And I lost all my friends. I just held this girl's hand really tight and we ended up together somewhere near the front, but lost everybody else.
Wow. That's incredible. That's incredible.
I wish I could remember her name. That's funny. It's funny how these things escape you 20 something years later.
It sounds like that's great. Hey, this is how I met my wife. I held on to her in a surge of people, and now we have four kids or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny how life doesn't work out that way, right?
Yeah, you know, and it's just amazing to listen to. One of the questions I was going to ask you is, we could just jump right into it. You know, a lot of times, you know, if you were to scan any composer's resume, a lot like yours, they're varied, impressive. And they hit all these different markets. But I gotta wonder, what, if anything, is the most elan? Because, you know, sometimes when, as a composer, when you're commissioned to do something, you're either interpreting a style or doing something that the director wants, but it may not, I mean, it's you who produces it, but it may not be you to your core. So is there a project, or whether it's a film or a side thing, what is the most elan piece of music you've ever come up with?
I'd like to answer that question because it's a really good question. But I don't know if I can answer it. I can answer it in terms of periods of time in my life.
Okay.
I think that the industry, certainly in film and television, but perhaps across the board, has fallen into, I think it used to be a very creative, collaborative space. But I think in the last 10, maybe even 20 years, that has shifted. I think through my career, I've seen it shifting where it's less that, where the composer has started to be seen less as a collaborator and more as a craftsman, like it may sound, I'm conscious when I talk about this, that it may sound that I'm in some way being derogatory or derisory about the roles. I'm not at all. These are just choices. But where the composer is seen a bit more like perhaps a set designer or person who builds props. So the way that you might work with those people might be a bit more like, this is what I want. Can you just build this for me, right? It's a craft. It's like somebody coming and building furniture in your house. And you're like, I need a chest of drawers, right? Now, some people are going to be more talented at that. Some people are going to be less talented. Some people are going to make amazing stuff, right? But they're not going to make you they're going to make you a functional thing. It's craft, right? Whereas, you know, if you asked some, you know, Salvador Dali to make you a chest of drawers, right? That's not going to be a functional chest of drawers, right? That's going to be some crazy ass piece of shit that's in an art gallery, right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So for several years of my career, I found myself, without particularly thinking about it, being drawn into this. Well, I want it and needing to, right? I need to build my career. I need to earn money. I'm going to take this project. I'm going to take that project. I'm going to do this. I've been asked to do this. I want to do this, but I'm not allowed to do this. So I'm going to do what they told me to do. And increasingly, this thing of copy the temp, and trying to find boundaries. You know, there was a project, I'm not going to say what, where I was asked to copy the temp, and I said to the director, no, I'm not doing that. Ring the composer. You know that composer. You've worked with him before. Ring that composer and ask him to come on board. Then ask him to copy his. I'm not copying his work. You know, I won't do that. But it happens all the time. I won't say what. I watched something last night, something pretty big and mainstream. And at the beginning of it, I was like, oh, they licensed my track. And then I was like, oh, no, they didn't. You know, it's a shocker. There's tons of things like that out there that all composers are dealing with all the time. I don't fight those things because I'm more about positivity and moving forwards. Life's too short to be sort of, you know, arguing with people about bits of film music. But there came a point where I thought, why am I doing this? What am I getting out of it as an artist? Because, well, I asked myself this question. Do I want to be a craftsman? Do I want to be a businessman? Or do I want to be a craftsman? Or do I want to be an artist? And the answer is, I want to be an artist for me. And I'm not saying that, again, I want to be really clear that I'm not being in any way derisory about the choices. Different people may want to do different things. I'm not saying one is better than the other. I could say certainly that what I'm choosing to do is not the path to making more money. Definitely not. The projects I've turned down are like, you know, they're insane. You know, it's like you'd have to be like literally insane to turn down some of the things I've turned down in the name of wanting to pursue my own artistic ideals. But to come back to the A Perfect Planet, which you know we've done a good job of not talking about at all, but we probably should. The first thing I did when I came into that meeting, the first thing I said was this is the way that I want to approach this. I don't want to do this in the traditional symphonic way. You've done that lots of times. I want to take a very contemporary approach to this score. And I want to do my thing. I want to make it really thematic and I want to do it in my way. And if you don't like that, if when I say that to you, that worries you, if what you want is somebody who you can say, no, I want you to do this and they'll do what you tell them to do, then I'm not the person for you. Don't hire me. And that's pretty much how I begin every meeting. I'm like, this is my vision of how I'm going to do your thing. Do you want to come on this journey with me? If not, let's not begin it.
You know, I think that's one of the most honest responses that I've ever got to really any question on this show. And I think it shows a lot of distinction when you say that you're turning things down because you want to pursue your vision, you know, what you think is right for the film. And it's interesting what you said about the aspect of the composing industry changing about 20 years ago, because 20 years ago, at least as far as IMDb shows, that was your first credit. And so, you know, had you got in 5 years before, had you delayed yourself 5 years, I wonder, you know, would you have, you'd probably have different experiences, bar none. But I think, you know, at what point in those 20 years do you feel like you really turned a corner,
I think it would be pretty clear to see that I'm doing like 3 or 4 movies a year up until about 5 years ago. and since then I've done like 3 movies, but I've done other things that I care about. I also have to be very honest about this. I'm in a position where I can afford to take these risks. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, like literally financially afford to take these risks, right? I'm not, you know, if I got into a position where I was struggling to put food on the table for my daughter, then of course I'd do whatever it was that I needed to do. You know, there's a real life aspect. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, I'm making I'm making it work, making the choices I'm making. It might not be the wealthiest path that I'm choosing, but yeah, there is a real life aspect to it. But around that time, and maybe it's connected somehow to my daughter being born and the way that that makes us, you know, see the world in a slightly different way. I decided, I was like, I just want to do things differently. And so I decided to write ballets and do projects where I was in control, more in control of my creative output. I created a ballet called Narcissus and Echo. I was very fortunate to be able to convince Sergei Polunin and Natalia Osipova, who are the two of the greatest living dancers in the world, to perform it for me. And we did a bunch of sold out shows with that. And David LaChapelle did all the design for it. It was amazing. And then I did another ballet straight after that. And then I wrote a show. I spent about the last 4 years creating a show with the European Space Agency and a British astronaut called Tim Peake. To make that show, I ended up directing a silent movie. Because the show takes place across three screens and it's music only, and it tries to describe the experience of going into space as an ass, you know, there's so many documentaries, interviews, technical information about the astronaut experience, but what's the emotional narrative of it? What's the emotional experience? And there's something that they all share. They share this thing. Some people call it the overview effect. This experience of being off the planet. And only 550 or so people have ever been off the planet.
Wow, that few, huh?
Very few, yeah. But they all share this experience of looking back down on the planet and understand, and the moonwalkers, by the way, even more extremely, you know, this sense of looking down on the planet and seeing it in a holistic way and not being on the planet and seeing how, I don't know, there aren't words for it. And the reason there aren't words for it was why I wanted to try and express it through music. And so we did this show in Stockholm in the summer of 2019. And then we were meant to, you know, after that, you know, the spring after that, 2020, we were meant to go on tour. And the show, by the way, I was terrified about doing the show because we had a satellite link up to the International Space Station, which is an amazing thing to be able to do. And we had a couple of astronauts on the ground talking to the commander of the International Space Station in space live on wow. 30 meters worth of screens to 10,000 people in Stockholm in the main square there. And then we came on to do my show and I had no idea. I mean, this is a risky idea, right? It's like Fantasia. Fantasia works, right? But it's a one-off.
Yeah.
Like there aren't loads of people who made things like, you know, just, hey, it's just music and a bunch of abstract images that express some sort of emotional thing. There isn't like a great canon of like successes like that, right? So I was shitting myself. And so we came out on stage, you know, me and my synth band, three players and someone on drums and a guitar and an orchestra of choir and strings and some brass. And we started performing this thing. It was nearly an hour long. And I thought, there's 10,000 people here now, and there's going to be 10 people left at the end of this. But actually, there wasn't. They all stayed. There was 10,000 people there at the end applauding. And I was like, fuck, okay, I've actually done something that, sorry, I'm swearing a lot. I'm assuming it's mostly an adult audience. But you know, there's, you know, I've done something that actually makes sense. Hopefully, you know, seems like it. So anyway, but then the pandemic hit and all of that got put on hold, but we're just in the process of putting that all back together for 2022. So, you know, watch this space. all of this was to answer the question of, you know, trying to do my own things and artistically expressing myself. So there's all of that. And then there's the projects that come along, like this David Attenborough Perfect Planet, or like Ghost of Tsushima, which I was reluctant to do at first, but I was so inspired by the unexpected and powerful storyline, and by the sort of creative ambitions and the creative freedom that was offered to me by Sucker Punch and Sony, that I, you know, but I choose my projects very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I don't think I could have asked for a better answer, because when I asked what is the most Elon project, it's the one that you did. I mean, your idea, whether it's the performance one or the one with Tim Peake, I think that probably stands head and shoulders above a Kick-Ass or Nick Moran's The Kid, because it is really your baby. You know, you're not a craftsman, like you said. So
yeah,
I like absolutely. That answer. Well, then, you mentioned Perfect Planet a couple times, and that's really the meat and potatoes of this show. I really never thought that I would be excited about listening to music for a flamingo, or there's quite a few other ones. The Hardy Heads, Manta Rays. I mean, like half of the playlist is, I mean, I love every other one. And I'm just wondering, you know, your fourth time into the documentary fold with Sir Attenborough, maybe can you go to the beginning and, you know, talk about the first steps to this endeavor?
You know, it is very daunting, because there are so many characters. You know, but normally you write something and you know, you have a handful of characters, you write those themes, and then you're working with that material. In this, it's like writing 45 short films, and each one is a different plot and a different genre and a different theme. You know, one minute it's, you know, you've got ants that are on a heist. The next minute you've got, it's an unrequited love story. And the next minute you've got a story of survival against the odds. You know, it's like there are all these different classic stories within the animals. And that's the way that I saw it. I'd look at these creatures and I'd say, okay, what's their story? In one sense, you're anthropomorphizing it, but actually in another sense, this is the story of all living creatures, right? We are all dealing with survival, with procreation, eating, with, you know, these basic animal things. And so that bit of it is a marathon, you know, it's really, really challenging. The way I approached it is I thought, I'm just going to watch each scene and I'm going to just jot down an idea, even if it's a terrible idea. I'm just going to be right, guitar for this one, quick string melody for that one. And then I'd go back around it and I'd be like, that one was good. I'm going to work on that one. That one's terrible. Forget that. I'll come up with something new, you know? And that's the way that I approached it. Like a sort of quick fire rounds. And then the other thing that was really important to me was, often with these shows, because of the way that they're created, you go from thing to thing to thing. And so it's like this long sort of endless running flow of music. But I really wanted an anchor. I really wanted to have this theme that you would come back to, this idea of this is the planet. This is the perfect planet. This is Mother Nature. This is what sustains us. And that was all about positivity. That was all about celebrating the planet. You know, we have an episode on volcanoes, and traditionally volcanoes are things to be terrified of, but are not in this series. Volcanoes are to be celebrated. They're a building block of life. We couldn't exist without them. And so I wrote this theme that recurs. Sometimes it comes in a sort of darker, sadder way, sometimes in a more majestic way, but it's always got choir and these arpeggio moving strings, and it's the main title track. And I got children's choirs to sing on it. I really liked this idea of inspiring children, and also because that's what it is. You know, why we talk about we have to save the planet, but why do we have to save the planet? We don't have to save the planet for you and me. Like, it might get a little bit worse, it might get a bit hotter, and there might be some worse storms, but the chances are that in our lifetimes, it's not going to be that bad, right? We want to save the planet for our children, for our children's children. And then I really thought about that with, you know, having a five-year-old daughter and the way that I interact with her. And, you know, I'm always saying that this is the recycling. It's paper. It's plastic. What's the difference? Teaching, you know, at that age, you're teaching the difference between paper and plastic and metal, right? They're learning to recognize these things. And why is it important to put it in this dustbin and not in that dustbin? Why should we not waste this food? If we are throwing this food away, why should we compost it? You know, all these things. Now, when I grew up in the 80s, we didn't talk about things like that. I mean, there was a brief moment about acid rain or something, but yeah, do you remember that?
I do. I think I was in third grade. It was like 89.
But we were mostly worried about the buildings. Mm-hmm. We weren't worried about the destabilizing the planet. And then I think, well, all right, if everybody knows to teach their children these things, then the children are going to grow up and they're going to be the next business leaders, the next scientists, the next doctors, the next world leaders. And in their core, in their essence, is going to be a different outlook. And that is really important. So that's why I wanted a contemporary approach to the music. I was like, we've got to engage with children. And that's why I wanted children to sing on it, because those children, we couldn't tell them what they were doing, but when they found out what they were doing afterwards, the messages I've had back from the teachers, from the schools, even from the kids, you know, I just over there, actually, yesterday, I received a handwritten note that they wrote to the student, to the production, and that they forwarded on from one of the kids who sang on the choir, so inspired. And so in my own small way, I'm trying to, you know, trying to do something to help, because God knows we need as much education about what we're doing to the planet as possible, so that we can try and improve the situation.
Oh, I agree totally. And not that this is totally relevant, but just more of the mindset of how one generation can change the way they used to be. I mean, you see how many few people are now smoking, versus, you know, 30 years ago. You know, cars in the 60s didn't have seatbelts. And then you're reinforcing these things on a personal level. And, you know, I feel to some degree we've bettered ourselves, but we can take it a step further, like you said, teaching your daughter about which bin's the rubbish, which bin is recycling. So I think it's possible. And I agree with you. It's not going to be, you know, it's easy to buy into what movies show us of, you know, 2 years from now, something catastrophic can happen. And, you know, we may or may not have control, and how much of that is, you know, fiction versus fact. But I think that, you know, taking these baby steps is as the best you could do. And I think that's admirable.
I think the smoking example is a really interesting one, because part of the problem with climate is, as human beings, you know, we can imagine next year, a couple of years, 5 years down the line, but 10 years down the line, emotionally, biologically, we're not really built to understand that, right? We don't know. I have no idea. Who knows where we're going to be or what's going to be happening 10 years down the line. But the idea that we're doing something now that is going to have some kind of effect 50, 60, 70, 80 years down the line, that's a very hard thing to understand. And that was the problem with smoking, right? Because I can remember smoking, you know, it was like, you know, you'd be like, yeah, I'm smoking, and oh yeah, lung cancer, but that's going to happen when I'm 60. Why does that matter? They really had to ram home that message. They had to find really clever ways to make that message clear to people. But it's very difficult for that to enter, for people to understand that, in the for the human consciousness to grapple with that. So we have that problem with climate as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I do it as well, right? It's like I wrap my Christmas presents for, you know, too many of them, and then waste all this paper, and it's cold, and I want my house to be warm, and I want my daughter to have a warm bedroom, right? You know, so, and I'm just using up energy. So, you know, it's like, you know, it's not like I'm saying, you know, hey, we're just all going to put on some extra sweaters or something, you know. It's so we have all these problems. A lot of them are problems of the mind as much as anything else.
Sure. Well, I'd like to go back to what you said kind of at the beginning of Perfect Planet. One of the things you talked about is hope. And there's another aspect about when you do a documentary, you never really want to tell somebody how to feel. You're kind of just letting the facts speak for themselves. And, you know, when you're scoring something, there's the idea of Mickey Mousing it or playing it so cartoony that you're following every beat. So with a movie about, with a show about the planet, it ends with themes like reforestation, a changing planet, and then also the beats where maybe a hyena may follow a water buffalo. So you can talk about hope in the small scale, but then hope in the big scale. And when you score something, I guess how much of it is Mickey Mousing or influencing? And then again, going back to the idea of an underlying hope, if any of that makes sense.
Absolutely. Well, the first four episodes are different, right? Because they're all about, they're more in line with the way that these programs are normally made, where you're anthropomorphizing the animals. I personally don't like this Mickey Mousing approach. I mean, if it was a kid's cartoon, I'd be good with it. But, you know, Shaun the Sheep, that, of course, that's what you want to do. But it's something like this, that's not really the route I like to take. I like to look at the emotional circumstance that's driving it forwards rather than expressing the actions through music. What's the character feeling, whether it's a person or an animal or whatever? And the way that I did that is, remember I talked about these quick fire rounds I would do. I would then work these ideas up into pieces of music, because I wanted to take a contemporary approach. All the music is very, for the most part, verse chorus, and so I'd write the piece of music, and then I would stick the piece of music on top of the film. And my challenge to myself was, okay, change this as little as possible so that the integrity of the music remains. And what can I do to achieve that? And so as a result, I feel like I was left with something musically very, the integrity of the music really remained, the melodic integrity of it. It wasn't really bent out of shape. And I just decided I'm not gonna hit that, and I'm not gonna worry about that, because actually what I'm doing is I'm not trying to tell the story. A sound effect will tell that story of the physical action. I'm going to tell a more emotional story. And it didn't work all the time, but it did work 90% of the time, more than I expected it would. And then in terms of hope and not manipulating the audience too much, that question came more in the fifth episode, where you're dealing more with scientific facts, scientists informing you about stuff. Early in my career, I did a lot of medical documentaries, just randomly. It was the sort of niche I fell into. And what I found with those is that if you pushed the emotion too hard, then you undermined the documentary, and the audience felt manipulated and would not believe it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so you had to hit it spot on. Whereas, you know, if you're doing a fantasy film of any kind, animation or, you know, Stardust, you know, you could push that emotion as far as you like, and the audience will suspend their disbelief for you and they're happy to go on the ride. But if you're trying to impart factual information, then you've got to tread a very, very fine line. And we talked at great length with the director and the series producer about this. Really, it was really the defining thing, and I fought really hard. I was like, we have to hold back here. We cannot dramatize. If you dramatize the scientist saying we are causing all this damage to the planet, the audience are going to stop believing us. We're going to undermine the authority of the scientist. So let's pull it back. And then there came the hope. Yeah, but because I hope I'm not sounding like one of these climate doomsday people. I do think we're in a very precarious situation. I do think it's very scary. But I also think that we are incredibly intelligent. I mean, just look at the last year when human beings, when our backs are up against the wall, look at what we can achieve. Look at what we can do. It's extraordinary. And I believe that we will find a way through. We are incredibly intelligent animals. And so that's where the hope was, and that had to come across in the music. Because if you tell people all the time, well, you know, we're doing this and it's bad and it's bad and we're in trouble and it's terrible and it's bad, then, you know, if you hear enough of that, like, you can't even, you're just like, oh, well, screwed anyway. Like, who wants to do anything about it? There has to be a reason to act. And that reason, the reason to act, has to be hope. It has to be the understanding that we can make it better. We can save the planet, save ourselves, save the animals. Well, certainly the other mammals on the planet. God knows life will continue with or without us. But yeah, there has to be hope. So that was really important. That was a very, very important part of it.
And I'm really impressed, and I like hearing that the discussions at length, like you said, to which you made these conscious decisions on what the right artistic path forward was to achieve the desired effect. And, you know, I watched one of the most impacting documentaries I'd seen recently was called Virunga, which is about the
incredible.
I
agree. Yeah, that really moved me.
And that bordered, I mean, you've got such dire consequences for these park rangers who are trying to protect the national park from poachers. Mm. And it's getting into wartime scenarios. And I mean, the amount of effort put forth to protect the planet and these gorillas, I mean, it almost seems like the steepest 89 degree uphill battle you could take. And similarly, like what you said, if you have so much opposition, if you feel like it's so, you know, you've lost the cause, it's you're basically reading history. You're not reading you're watching a documentary. But at the end, they were able to weave in that, yes, there's still possible, you know, even in the darkest days, they find a way to tread forward. So there's a parallel there, but I think that what you're saying about your efforts for a perfect planet are well stated. So to that point, you know, I'm watching episodes about manta rays and Arctic foxes, and I never thought I'd like a gibbon so much. When you have these episodes or these sequences in front of you, do you ever look at it and you just go, that's so majestic. Why do you need my music? You know, I guess I'm supposed to do something here. You know, how do you come in versus silence?
Good question. I am a great believer. I mean, just to talk about technique for a moment, I'm a great believer that when you're making a film or a TV show, you're not a composer. That's not your job. You're a filmmaker. And the bit of filmmaking you are involved with is the music. But just as important as creating the music and deciding where the music goes is deciding where the music doesn't go. We were taught this lesson by Bernard Herrmann in The Birds. I mean, that is the ultimate, right? And you know, there's no score until the end credits. And so I really take that lesson to heart. So I always ask myself that question, where can I come out? Where do we not need music? And there's also, you know, there's a lot of people who always, with the perfect planet as well, it's no exception. But I am very well aware a very large amount of people complaining about music too loud, too much music in these kinds of things. Oh, why do we have to drown out David Attenborough's amazing commentary with this annoying music? You know, get that all the time. So I was really acutely aware of that. However, I feel like that in order to express what's going on with the animals, sometimes you look at the pictures, it's quite hard to know. And the director is saying to you, well, this is what's happening. This is the story here. And you really need the music to help narrate the story as well as David's words. You know, there was one recently where somebody was complaining about the music in the Silver Ants. And there's actually the story in the Silver Ants in the Sahara Desert in the Sunlight episode. There isn't a huge amount of narration in that because the story is very simple. It's a heist. The ants, you know, the sun's coming up. It's nearly noon. And the animals are all running away and hiding away. But there's some of the animals that don't make it out of the sun in time. The ants and start dying in the heat. The ants run out and they grab them. But they've only got a certain amount of time for the ants before it gets too hot for them and they're going to die. So it's literally a heist. They've got this amount of time to get their food and to get it. And then as they're coming back in, I'm sorry, this is some spoilers here. As they're getting back to the ant hole that they live in, they've got this beetle and they've like overcome these great things to get it there. And then they get it to like the door and it's too big to fit in and all the ants are coming out. And they're going to die any second because it's too hot out there. Yeah. Right? So it's an amazing heist, right? But the story is really quite, it's not an elaborate story. It's a very straightforward story. There isn't that much commentary. And I saw, you know, for anyone who thinks that we don't read all the comments, good and bad, we do. And I saw on Twitter, some person complaining about the music in particular, and I was quite proud of that sequence because it's all electronic. It's like a crazy electronic sequence. It's very unusual for a series like this. But complaining, bitterly complaining about the music. Why do we have to have all this noisy music getting in the way? Why can't we just have sound effects and David Attenborough's voiceover? And I'm thinking, well, hold on a second. David has very little voiceover in narration in this particular sequence. And sound effects, like they're ants on sand. There isn't any sound effects. Like what sound do you think the ants are making walking about? And like, I mean, there's nothing. And so, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, I think is the answer there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's, or like they say, you can't please all the people all the time. So, yeah. But you know, it maybe in the defense of that person, it's possible that they just maybe need to see it again, or and maybe a quick follow up to that is, have you had thoughts about the way something should be based on either this read through the script or discussion with, you know, Matthew Vaughn or Ray Fiennes, and then you watch something, you go, I think this is going to work, and then you come back to it, you go, I was wrong. Or it's, you know, now I understand it better. You know, do you have any?
Yeah, all the time, of course. Absolutely. You try things out. There's something funny that happens when you put music up against the screen, you know, the chemistry of that, the music changes and the images change, you know, the chemistry affects everything. So yeah, there's no, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't quite think of the word, but there's no, there's no better way to do it than to just try it and see how it comes out.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, you have a great idea and it doesn't stick. And in fact, most of my ideas don't stick. You know, I work really, you know, I think about it like bands, you know, people seem to often be surprised. They think, oh, well, you just wrote that. And then you put that on there. And then you wrote that and you put that on there. I don't know about my, never really spoken about this with my peers. I don't know how they work, but the way I work, I'm like a band, you know. I most bands, right, they don't write 12 songs and just put that out. They write 20 songs, 30 songs, 50 songs, and they whittle it down and whittle it down and whittle it down until they've got the 12 best. And that's how I do it. There's tons and tons of things that I wrote for A Perfect Planet, for Ghost of Tsushima, for all sorts of things that you know, never made it in and will never ever see the light of day because, frankly, they're just not good enough.
Well, do your best, not shit. And if it's shit, don't show it to anybody.
Exactly.
That's great. Although, you know, like I'm in a creative industry, not quite as amazing as yours, but I work for an architecture firm and we do hotels and resorts. And a lot of times, you know, you try a round table in a living room one day and you come back, it doesn't work. You try a rectangle and you just, you know, you try things and, you know, you over the course of revisions and trying it, you know, giving it more than just your first pass, you'll find your path. But has there been anything that surprised you and go, this was my first at bat and I don't know how it stuck the entire way through the process, but didn't change one bit?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been things like that. I suppose the thing that springs to mind like that is on Ghost of Tsushima, the main theme, which is called The Way of the Ghost, was one of the first things that I wrote. And I really loved it. It was a very sort of pure, you know, the entire piece of music is based on a very simple Japanese pentatonic scale. It's a very simple melody. And I loved it, but, you know, for whatever reason, it didn't stick. And I wrote a whole lot of other music. And we worked on the game for maybe nearly a year until one day we revisited that theme. And everybody was like, me included, we were all just like, actually, this is really good. And it ended up being the main theme.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't know. It's funny, right? The way things evolve. It's not normally a straight line. That's all I can say. I think I think you described it very well. You know, you're playing with it. You're molding it. It's like clay, and then it doesn't set immediately. You know, you have time even after you made it to sort of mess with it, and then slowly, it just begins to set. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was another one actually on A Perfect Planet, the Sooty Shearwater scene at the end of the Sunlight episode, and I'd written this thing and I'd orchestrated it and we were ready to play it with the orchestra, and 2 days before we were recording, the director was like, I'm sorry, it's just not working for me, and then I had to write another thing. It was a big long 6-minute sequence, the whole finale, the whole episode. It's a nightmare, but you know what, the end result, can't argue with it. It came out really good. Yeah, he pushed me in it and it worked. So, you know, there's so many different processes.
Well, you know, documentaries, especially nature documentaries, are intended to be for all audiences. Has your daughter been able to see what you're working on? Do you share her with them?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of stories I'd love to share with you, but she watched the first episode and she talked all the way through it. It's very sweet, but she saw bits of it all the way through, you know, and there was one bit in the weather episode where I wonder if I could show you this, where she, there are these, again, spoiler alert, there are these turtles. And the turtles were getting sick. Not sick. The tides are coming up, and they're getting drowned. And these baby turtles, and a lot of these baby turtles die, and it's because of climate change that the tides are changing, and the way that the mother turtles are burying the eggs. It's like, you know, they can't know because of the flooding, and you know, and it's really tragic. Anyway. And she was really obsessed with these turtles. She's also been learning the piano and she's been learning to play Rain, Rain, Go Away. But she likes to do like thunder on the low notes of the piano just by bashing her hands down there. So I was like, okay, well, you can help me out. Do you mind You'll get the audio here. It's not entirely fair for your listeners because they won't see the video, but I'll show you, which is her helping me out in my little home studio in lockdown.
When you see the thunder, you do the thunder music for me, all right? All right.
Emerald from the river, just as the water starts to rise.
Oh, that's great.
So, there you go.
What a great memory.
So she helped out with that. And the other major contribution she made to this show was the song, A Perfect Planet. I talked about having children singing on it, but actually she was the inspiration for that because she is by far and away my harshest critic. And I'll give you an example. One time we were on a plane on a long haul flight, and she was, must have been 4 years old, maybe three and a half. And she was watching Shaun the Sheep, the movie, which of course I did score to. And halfway through it, I said to her, because she chooses her own thing, she used to do the iPad and stuff. Halfway through it, I said to her, do you know who wrote the music for that? Daddy wrote the music for that, like all sort of proud of myself. And she literally just stopped it and changed the channel and started watching something else. I was like, I thought that would start when she was a teenager, not at four.
Oh my God.
But when I was writing the main theme, A Perfect Planet, there's the track title on the album, she started singing it around the house and she really liked it. And that's what gave me the idea that maybe I'd written something that was simple, I don't want to say simple enough, but memorable enough and direct enough that young kids, could sing it. And so that inspired that idea.
No, that's fantastic. And if kids are going to get on long, kids can gravitate towards something if they can see themselves in it. So hook them early with some music. That's a yeah. way to grab that audience. I'm glad you brought up Shaun the Sheep. I just want to share one of my favorite scenes. It's when the farmer has woken up and doesn't know who he is. And my favorite scene in a whole movie is when he's in the trailer riding along on the streets and the truck passes him and he looks out the window thinking it's in the mirror of the sink. And he sees the good looking man on the truck, the advert, and he looks, hey!
Yeah, it's really funny.
Like, I'm having a good day. It's my favorite scene in the whole movie. What were some of your most enjoyable parts? And
oh God, the barber, the sheep when they have to sing the pop song.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is, I'm one of those sheep. I really fought against it, but I am one of those sheep. So that's my only vocal performance on a movie.
That's great.
I really loved doing that. I spent a lot of time at Aardman, hanging out there and working upstairs and going down and visiting the sets. They're just they're a wonderful, very inspiring company. And the director, everybody was lovely. It was really a very happy time. It was difficult, for sure. It was a silent movie. It was a tremendous amount of work. And, you talk about that scene when he's in the caravan and you start off on the farm, and on the farm, it was all sort of very acoustic farm, acoustic guitars and ukuleles and pots and pans. It was like a very sort of farmyard approach. And then as it gets towards the city, it becomes literally the concept was that the music becomes more electric. So So electric guitars come in and synths come in and an orchestra comes in, and it had literally every genre, every type of instrument, every type of music. That track was one of, in terms of depth of amount of instruments, it was insane, just that track. It was huge. And then I had to, you know, we did this dog bone, you know, the bits are like chasing the bone. That was a really tough one to crack. What's the music? And Bitzer was always like the older teenage brother to Sean, right? The dog. And so we were like, oh, maybe what he does is he listens to sort of Barry White. So we were like, we did this this thing. It was like, and if you listen to the album, it's the song on that my friend Chad, who's a brilliant composer, by the way, he did the Michael Jackson documentary. He used to be in a pop band before. I got him out for a time and I was like, you've got to sing this. And like the whole thing is it's like this sort of Barry White groove, and the lyrics are like, you're mine, come and eat me, you're mine, you know? And so there were all these like insane ideas the whole way through, and I kept getting like sort of rock and roll mates to come in and perform like parts of it and then do different bits of it. It was an enormous amount of work. It was truly a labor of love doing Shaun the Sheep. But the whole thing is littered with jokes, like the way they name all the shop fronts have all got funny names and little in jokes and all different stuff, but also the music is just absolutely riddled with little musical in jokes the whole way through. So yeah, it was great. It was a great experience.
That's fantastic. You know, I'm going to have to go back and watch that sequence again to hear the transition that you're talking about from the farm to the more electric sounds.
Dude, and check out the I can't remember what we called the song. I think it's just called You're Mine. Check that out, because it's very short in the film, but we made like a whole pop song, five-minute long song the album. It's definitely worth a listen. And when you know, it's also the vocal is by a very accomplished, very serious composer as well. It's even funnier.
That's great. You know, I think one of my favorite Aardman films to date is Pirates, Band of Misfits. And when you're talking about little in-jokes and things like that, I mean, even from the very beginning, it opens on a man, it says, you know, England, 1853 or something like that. And it's this shot where you come in through the window of the Queen's Palace, and that little placard that says 1853 or whatever is held by a man. And as it tracks and as it zooms out, you see him, and he wasn't supposed to be in the shot, so he doesn't know what to do, and he just kind of looks funny. So it's this whole, you know, very Mel Brooks in a way, and it's so cute. Well, you know, one of the things about being in any business is the longevity, thanks to friends, relationships, collaborators. Can we spend a little bit of time talking about Ralph Fiennes and Matthew Vaughn and people that you find yourself going through the trenches again every time a project comes along?
Sure. Well, where do you want to start? Who do you want to start with?
I think we'll start with Rafe, because I think one of the things you told me last time is the efforts to put any music in Coriolanus was like pulling teeth at first. The idea of a trumpet and you kind of want him.
Rafe was, I think, a little nervous about music, and remains, you know, music changes performances, and he's an actor, right? So he's very cautious about that. But over the years, you know, we've developed a very firm friendship and a really good creative collaboration. We've done three films together now. On the last one, The White Crow, which is the story of the legendary ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev, that was a real challenge, one of the biggest ones, because the first thing I thought was, okay, this film is going to be littered with classical music by the greatest composers. I mean, how do you follow Tchaikovsky, right?
Sure.
And I thought, well, one of the big problems with film music versus classical music is that film music is in a supporting role. And so it is typically not as busy, you know, not as detailed, not as flowery, not as, you know, you need to give it a bit more space.
Sure.
For the dialogue to come through. And for the audience to accept all the visual images as well. And so I said to Rafe, all right, what I'm going to do, because we've been talking about making this movie for 3 years, maybe 4 years even, you know, plenty of dinners, plenty of ideas thrown around. And we talked a lot about Nureyev and what he was like and who he was, and, you know, over martinis and other nice things that we could do pre-lockdown. And it wasn't immediate, but suddenly this idea dawned on me. I thought, okay, actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to write classical pieces of music that bear no resemblance to what normal film music would be like. They're just going to be detailed symphonic classical pieces of music. I'm going to give them to, I said, I'm going to give you, Rafe, and in the edit suite, you're going to pretend that these are pieces of music that you've discovered. You don't know the composer. You can't change them. You can't do anything with them. They are like bits of music you discovered, and you can cut them into your film. And that's it. And that's how we're going to work. And Rafe, I mean, bless him, whatever crazy idea I throw at him, he's really up for it. In fact, he's the worst person to give an idea like that to, because he's such a purist in his artistic vision that once you give him an idea like that, he's like, no, no, we're sticking to that idea. You cannot deviate from that idea, right? And so, you know, I kind of made a rod for my own back, but you know, and then in the final process, yes, did we tweaked it and we made it fit and things, but everything was written in that spirit. There was even one bit when I had this idea that when Nureyev arrived in Paris for the first time, Russia would be this very romantic, late romantic Russian style music, and it's with this solo violin and all that stuff. And it is, it's like this sort of late period Russian romantic style. And then when he arrives in Paris, it's like it's the 60s, it's modern, it's like it's completely different. And I was like, how am I going to express that, but still through classical music? And so it was anachronistic by just a few years, like maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years. But I decided to take Steve Reich, a sort of Steve Reich, Philip Glass, more Steve Reich approach to the music there. And so I was writing these very different kinds of pieces of music. And that piece I wrote, and I gave it to him, and he cut it in, and he brought me in and he showed it to me. And he was like, I'm just not sure this is really working. Can you like try something else? And I was like, are you sure? Because it seems pretty good to me. And he was like, it's just not doing it for me. I was like, all right, I'm just going to go and write something else. And I spent like 10 days killing myself. And I just didn't have anything right. But I had like 3 ideas. And I hate to let Rafe down. And he's a really generous collaborator. So I don't mind showing him half ideas that I'm not entirely happy with. And I came into the cutting room with these half ideas ready to show him. And I was like, oh, you know, Rafe, I'm not sure. I've been really struggling with this. And he was like, no, listen, I would just want to show you this before you start. Sit down and watch this scene. And so I sat down and I watched the scene, and he showed me like the same scene, but like recut to like my same piece of music. And he was like, it's brilliant, right? And I was like, yeah, it's great, but like, thanks. No, but like, thanks for not telling me a few days earlier. I'd be torturing myself, literally.
Oh man. But you know, these are battle stories you have, and you know, you you, whether it's you get the rugby ball across the line or you cut the football in the end zone, it just, it's, you know, it's water under the bridge. But man, what an awesome experience. And you know, it's funny, I saw, you know, as a cinema goer, as someone who runs a site and a film fan my whole life, you know, we're watching these movies, we're watching these characters who are bigger than life, and somebody like Ralph Fiennes, you think that they're, you know, like a Jeremy Irons, a Sir Ian McKellen, this sort of, you know, like they're beyond humanity in a way, and because they're untouchable. But there's this sort of a blink and you miss it moment. I think it was an interview or a making of The Invisible Woman. I saw an interview with you, and Rafe's in the studio watching two players. I think it's a cellist and a violin for The Invisible Woman. And he's just sort of following along to the music, and he does this, and it just like puts his hand over his heart. So you got him. And it's just, it's such a touching moment to see that, you know, perception is that, you know, he seems as the untouchable actor, and then, you know, music won him over. I think it's a nice touchstone to what you do as a professional.
Oh, thanks for noticing that. But yeah, he's one of the most generous, creative artists I've ever had the good fortune to encounter. And I'm very grateful for my collaborations and grateful to be able to call him a friend.
That's fantastic. And, you know, we have Layer Cake coming up on its 20th anniversary in a couple of years. I would love to talk to you about that, maybe get you back on with Matthew.
That made me feel old. Thanks, man.
It's like a wine. I mean, like the glass you have in your hand. But, you know, I've been trying to track down some music to Layer Cake, and there's very little that's listed as Ilan Ishkeri's music. And what there is, you seem to share it with Lisa Gerard and another artist, sort of a techno artist. So can you talk about what's contributed?
Lisa was brought onto that film originally. But my understanding of it was that she had struggled. I mean, I hope I'm not talking out of turn. I have an enormous amount of respect for Lisa, and I'm a big fan of the Dead Can Dance, and you know, so you know, I hope I'm not talking out of turn, but my understanding was that she had struggled to deliver to Matthew what Matthew wanted for the film. There were elements that she had knocked out the park, and those were typically the vocal sequences. But there were other places that didn't quite work. And I came onto the film, and from meeting Matthew Vaughan and watching the film for the first time to being in Abbey Road Studios and recording the strings, that was 2 weeks exactly.
Serious.
So, I, you know, look, I was young and I didn't need to sleep as much back then. So... So I got through it, but it was really full on. It was really serious.
Okay.
But you know, it worked out okay. But there's two tracks on the album, Drive to the Boatyard and Drive to the Warehouse, and they were, for me, what the main theme was. And JJ, the author, he wrote a sequel, and I always hoped that we'd do the sequel, because I never really got to flesh those themes out in the way that I wanted to. There were other things, but this was early in my career, and it was definitely, those were the artistic pieces. There was a lot of functional stuff in that score. And I was, you know, fixing something in the last minute. So there wasn't a lot of options, but I would like to, those pieces, you know, Drive to the Boatyard, I wrote something for that scene, and Matthew didn't like it, and he left, and he was like, I'll come back tomorrow, and we had 2 weeks, right? My first meeting had just gone to shit. The director didn't like what I'd written, and this was like, not my first movie, but my first proper movie. And I stayed up all night rewriting that piece of music. I slept maybe an hour on the couch in the studio. and waited all day for Matthew to come back, absolutely shitting myself. And he came back and he was like, yeah, that's it, you got it. And I was like, thank fuck for that, you know. But I don't know what the point is of the story. It was that piece of music was born out of some kind of desperation, which was good because that was what was going on in the scene. Mm-hmm. But I think it also meant that it was like a true expression of myself. Anyway, so I really like that piece. It has a special place in my heart. That and its sort of sister piece, which is Drive to the Warehouse. And I'd love the opportunity, if anyone ever makes the you know, read the novel, it's fantastic, the sequel to Layer Cake. But if anyone ever makes that, I would love to revisit that music.
And you know, a pun not intended, it really is a driving theme in the film, as short as it is, that there's some great electronics to it. It's propulsive, it's not too fast, but it just has purpose to it. And I think that, like, you know, your efforts to write it kind of parallel the efforts of the protagonist XXXX to, you know, get out ahead. And I love that movie just for certain sequences, like when, you know, Daniel Craig says, you know, one day all of this drug business, monkey business will go away. Not when they realize that they're missing out on millions, but billions. And the pharmacy goes from, you know, black and white products of drugs to, you know, the things you find in the pharmacy, or that wonderful sequence where there's the fight in the cafe where...
With the music, yeah.
Yeah, and they bring an ordinary world, and then they kind of warp it to the beating, and then even Daniel Craig's, you know, his famous line in the beginning where he says, it's only very, very stupid people who think the law is stupid. I mean, every bit of that movie just works, and so I'm in some small capacity, I'm thrilled to be speaking to you about this as well. So would be nice to expand on, you know, sequel, or hell, if they make a vinyl of it, you know, maybe there's some expanded tracks. But
maybe, let's see. Nice idea for the 20th anniversary.
We've got 3.5 years. We'll make something happen. But Ilan, before we head out, can we maybe tell your listeners where to find you, what projects you have coming up, and what you're most excited to share?
Can I just share one story, actually, just before we do that? Just popped into my head, just because you've got these beautiful butterflies behind you on your wall over there.
They're made out of vinyl. My wife and I spent a weekend cutting 12 records into the shape of butterflies.
Wow, that's super cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, very cool. The very first time I collaborated with David, Attenborough, he came to the studio. We were recording at Abbey Road, and he spent the morning with me in the orchestra. It was a great privilege. It was really wonderful to have him sat next to me. He's a very good pianist, and he knows his music, and he can read music, and it's great to talk to about music. And we had a lovely day. And anyway, he left just before the lunch break, and I went out onto the studio floor, Abbey Road Studio One, where countless incredible movies have been recorded. I went out onto the floor and stood up on the podium to speak to the orchestra. And before I started speaking, and I might add before I say this next bit, that it was November, it was freezing cold outside. There were, of course, several doors to get to the internal bit of a recording studio, which is very soundproof, not really open to the outside world. So I walk across the floor, go to stand on the podium to speak to the orchestra. And before I say anything, a butterfly comes and just landed on the stand, on the conductor's, on the stand where the music was, and just sat there. And everyone was just stunned into silence. It was the most extraordinary and magical thing. It really was. And I mean, God knows what was a butterfly doing inside a recording studio in November. I mean, it makes no sense. I like to think that David somehow left it there for us as a sign of approval. So anyway, yeah, you just reminded me of that. But what were we finishing with?
What projects you have coming up?
Yeah, my next thing, I spoke about it already. Space Station Earth is really what I'm excited about next. And so tickets for that will be in Europe, and I suppose most of your listeners are American, so not much help. But anyone who's listening from Europe, tickets will go on sale in the not too distant future, in the next couple of months, I hope. We're just finalizing all these plans at the moment. So please, you know, follow me on social media. I'm just Ilan Eshkeri on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And also the project has its own things called Space Station Earth. And also please watch A Perfect Planet, because it's a really important show. In America, it's on Discovery. And I think it's important to watch and to learn from this show.
I think that's the perfect way to go out, Ilan. More to your point about the space shows, schools are opening up on March 8th, aren't they?
Well, I mean, I was hoping that they were going to open up after the half-term holiday in February. That was what they said initially. And now they're saying March 8th, but that will leave 2 weeks or 3 weeks maximum until the end of term. So I am beginning to think that we're not going back to school till the summer. So I shall look forward to sharing my office desk with my five-year-old daughter.
I did that all summer. It has its pluses and minuses, but I think that I've said this a couple of times. I've had more good memories last year than bad memories. So even though the world's gone tits up, so to speak, you know, family has flourished, and staying close to home has been beneficial. So sounds like
I couldn't agree more. We're blessed. I always think life is lockdown. As a parent is a very, very different experience to lockdown not as a parent.
True words have never been spoken. Well, thank you immensely for your time. Glad to be speaking with you, and have a great weekend.
Brilliant. You too, man. Thanks very much. Great chat.